Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It may feel like a Monday to me, or a Thursday, or a Tuesday, or God knows what. It seems like I've been away for a month. Golly Moses, I missed you guys. I'm telling you. Had a really enjoyable time at PowerShift 2009 in Washington, D.C., along with the whole fandamily. Berg was there, Doodle was there, Margie was there, Agnes was there. We all had a wonderful, wonderful time. And I hope you got to check out some of the speeches from Friday evening's opening session. It was quite exciting. I think you might want to check out Van Jones's remarks in particular. Unfortunately, we had an internet burp along about the time that former Salt Lake City, Utah Mayor Rocky Anderson had 12,000. Of America's future, America's youth, chanting in unison, there's no such thing as clean coal, there's no such thing as clean coal. Later on, clean coal was compared to unicorn-powered automobiles. Yeah, the message went through loud and clear. We'll talk a little bit more about that trip. And the fact that I'm still getting feeling back in the tips of my fingers from the brutally cold weather on Monday. But what an amazing event that act of civil disobedience was. Exciting to see the future of America standing up and demanding realistic change away from the screw-ups that my and previous generations have imposed upon them and their future, via the nasty, nasty, nasty utilization of the world's filthiest fuel source, namely, to wit, heretofore, therefore, and whereas, coal. It was exciting indeed. And people, you know, people from so many different places, meeting the American Indian groups from Black Mesa, folks from Alaska come to talk about what coal is doing to their communities. Folks from all over the Southeast talking about what mountaintop removal does, what coal-fired power plants do to their communities. From the Midwest, from the Upper Midwest, from the Mountain West, from the West Coast itself. Remember, all that Black Mesa coal from Arizona is mixed with water. You know, Arizona's largely desert and doesn't have a lot of water. But that's okay. Peabody Energy takes what little water there is and mixes it with ground-up coal and shoots it through a pipeline to a power plant that then burns it for holy, in a place where it's always sunny! But never mind. But anyway, it was all magnificent, and we'll talk about it later. So, yeah, it feels like Monday, it feels like Tuesday, it feels like God only knows. So, but we got a normal week for the rest of the week and a normal week next week, so hot diggity. But it's not just my first day back. It's not just the middle of the week. It's not just Wednesday. No, it's not hump day. Not downhill to Friday. No, brothers and sisters, hallelujah, it is prayer meeting Wednesday. Glory, choir master, fire it up.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen.
Amen.
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little plate when it comes around.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah. Hallelujah!
Hallelujah!
Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stuck the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
Hallelujah, brothers and sisters. Here I spent now through the bathroom there to the shamma of a ding dong. I love you. It is prayer meeting. Come on down. The doors of the Cathedral of Common Sense are open. I am Bishop Bob Kincaid. I got my fancy little bishopin' hat on and my bishopin' robes. Come on down the blood-red carpet and come down to the altar and lay your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the healing rays of common sense flowing through you. Glory! Hallelujah! Ho! This being prayer meeting and all, gotta have a good story to get us started. And I got one. It's been sitting around for a while because we haven't had a chance to get together like this for our usual congregatory. Whew, how's that for a $10 word, brothers and sisters? Congregatory meetings. But yes, we go to I can use the $10 words. I just can't say the $1 ones. Cresaptown, Maryland. That's where we go, one way or the other. And in Cresaptown, Maryland, we find good, upstanding, righteous, God-fearing ex-barber Joe Godlewski apparently likes to watch the Food Channel and such a little bit, and he's forever seeing them fancy chefs a-pouring some of that there kosher salt onto their hands and a-dumping it on their food. But Joe Godlewski, he's a Christian man, and he didn't like that kosher salt all the time a-being pushed about on unwitting viewers. So Joe Godlewski, he did something about it. Joe Godlewski has introduced and trademarked Blessed Christian Salt. And it will be available from Memphis, Tennessee-based Ingredients Corporation of America. Really? You've got a corporation and that's the best you can come up with? Ingredients Corporation of America. Ingredients Corporation of America will indeed be marketing Blessed Christian Salt. He's got an Episcopal priest who will bless it on the way to the capitalist commerce stream. I know, irony, it's lost on these daggum fundies, but what are you gonna do? And never mind the fact that kosher salt is not named, it's kosher, you know, it's not named kosher salt because it's not like there's a rabbi up there going, I bless the salt, I bless the salt, I bless the salt, I bless the salt. No! It's kosher because to kosher something is a cooking term. Koshering. Also known, anybody ever eat corned beef? Shh, don't tell the fundies, but there's no corn in corned beef.
to corn something is to salt something away as a preserving process. It is called corning because the grains of salt, come on, rock salt, if you live where it snows or ices, you've thrown it on the driveway, right? Chunky, like grain. And therefore, it is to corn beef is to use corns of salt. See, the word corn predates maize, which is, and we call it maize. Yeah, you know what I mean. So, all of this is lost on a fundy like Joe Godlewski. Joe Godlewski probably apparently has some grain, corn perhaps, of hateful racial bias hiding somewhere down in his Christian soul. And that's right, he's offended by the concept of that unchristian salt. And he sees an opportunity, frankly, to make a dollar out of it. Sure, why not? Blessed Christian salt. Salt's just as good as that kosher salt, but you can use this and still get into heaven. Joe Godlewski has seen the future open before him, this retired barber. God, I hope there's no salt, no hair in the salt. But we did that story a couple of weeks ago, and it's the dinner hour, and I won't do that to you again. If the salt takes off, if the salt flies, he's already got plans for a whole line of blessed Christian foods. Anybody here ever read Robert A. Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land? The Fosterite religion? Hello? Just checking. Because, you know, the church has always been good at branding stuff. From architecture to paintings to liquor. Yeah. Frangelico, remember? Agnes loves Frangelico. I mean, not that she's, you know, sitting around drinking it through a straw, but, you know, no, she's almost the ultimate teetotaler. But if she, I'd like a little bit of Frangelico, please. You know, like Mrs. Butterworth's is in the syrup bottle that's shaped like Mrs. Butterworth. Well, Frangelico is in a bottle that's shaped like a fryer. There you go. Sure. Exactly. So we start this evening with blessed Christian salt because Joe Godlewski has a religious objection to kosher salt. Yeesh. And this made the news. Yeah, I know. And Bob, why are you talking about it? Because it's prayer meeting and it's funny and pointing out the stupidity of fundamentalists. You know, yeah, I mean, he's got an Episcopal priest doing the blessing, so I guess he's not a hardcore. But somebody somewhere along the way should have disabused it. I mean, in fact, if you get right down to it, and I think either of our two resident experts on things pertaining to the Jewish faith could tell you that all salt is kosher salt. It's a mineral salt, you know, a mineral. I mean, it just is. Now, I don't know what would happen to Joe Godlewski if you explained to him that even if he gets it blessed by a priest and calls it blessed Christian salt, it's still kosher. Well, he knows the field's rules, and he'll never smarten up the chumps. Ethel, I think we'd better order us some of that blessed Christian salt. You know, I haven't seen that precious Paula Deen, and she uses that kosher salt. I wonder if she knows her soul's in turmoil. Ugh, fundies. And meanwhile, in Italy, a priest is suggesting, get this, a priest is suggesting that people give up texting for Lent. That young people stop text messaging each other for Lent. apparently, and he's focusing this on Italy. Yeah, no. None of that giving up. None of that giving, because this is all 40 days. Lent's 40 days long, right? And it is a mockery. I'm sorry, a mimicry of the 40 days that Yeshua, the brown-skinned Nazarene carpenter, spent fasting in the desert. So this Italian priest wants young people to give up text messaging. Yeah, never mind spending 40 days working for the poor. Never mind spending 40 days. No. Never mind spending 40 days feeding the hungry, housing the homeless. Quit text messaging each other. Because that's going to change the world. You stop that. What are you wearing? Could somebody tell Bishop, whatever his name is, over in Leghorn or Genoa or wherever, that text messaging isn't the reason that the church is losing its younger generation, that it has something to do with hypocrisy and, you know, watching an entire continent die because a hateful old anti-aircraft gunner for the Nazis says that African men can't have a little latex thingy on there, you know, to keep from spreading the HIV virus and burning up an entire continent. Could somebody get that message to the bishop? Maybe you could text message him, the bishop, because he didn't say he wanted the young people to give up the text messaging, so maybe you could text message Bishop What's-His-Face. But that's me and I'm crazy. So, you know, just a couple of fun things, to get us started this evening on prayer meeting. There are an abundance of topics out there for the rest of the evening. And something I didn't get around to last time we talked, which was, I think, what was that? When, it was a week ago. I want to play you a couple of tracks or at least a track this evening from Jason Isbell's new album, Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit. There are a couple of particularly trenchant tracks I think you'll enjoy. But for now, however, since it has been a while since we have talked, we're going to go straight to the phone lines. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah, we do have a you love that. I love you. Mekaleka, hi, Brother Bob.
Hey, Brother Albert, what's happening?
Oh, man, I'll tell you what, I missed you. I really did. What the hell kind of Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. Is that all that's all I can say regarding?
I leave and all the fun stories happen.
Oh, it's actually beautiful. It's just like implosions, and it's like the Death Star blowing up. It's gorgeous.
Do you realize I was in D.C. at the same time that Flimball was babbling to CPAC? You know, the irony was not lost on me, Albert. At the same time that Flimball was babbling to CPAC, you know, to that assembled horde of old, pasty, doughy white people who are on their way out, 12,000 young people who are on their way in were at the Washington Convention Center rejecting every last thing that conservatives and right-wingers and repiglicans that they stand for. It was like the rise of humanity and the disappearing dinosaurs. Goodbye. Goodbye, old dinosaurs. Goodbye. And there's Flimball. Who was supposed to, what was he, supposed to speak for 15 minutes, and he turned it into a Castro-like hour and some odd oration? And did you see the footage, Albert, of him up there bouncing and jiggling like some sort? Oh, my God, it was, yeesh.
Yeah, that was one thing I was kind of, I kept my palate clean because I knew that was coming up. I didn't watch the little kid until today. And I didn't watch a lot of that because I knew that it was going to take some fortitude and some purity of heart in order to get through some of Flush Flimball's. Oh, he's just such a scat muncher, this guy. I mean, when he called saying that he has a psychosis regarding, you know, it's a psychosis regarding because it's about emotions. And talking about money and spending other, like all these people, like he was, it was so transparent. It was so obvious as to who he works for and what he works for. And it's just, I mean, he's just disgusting. It's just week after week after week after week, the words just fly out of my mouth. These people are just stupefying. It's ridiculous. It's unreal.
Yeah, it is. And look, let's get one thing clear. And I really think this is sort of the Zen bottom line, where Flimball is concerned. And I put this in the chat room. I don't know if you'd popped in yet. Do you know why Flush Flimball says, "I hope he fails"? Because he can't get away with saying, "I hope he dies."
Yeah.
It's more, and it needs to be recognized for what it is. That business is more right-wing eliminationist rhetoric, and we have got to learn to identify it when we hear it and when we see it. And that's exactly what it is. Flush Flimball still hates the fact that, you know, that one is in the White House. You know, one of those people.
Yeah.
And it's driving him nuts. And he every day he hopes, he wants, no kidding, I mean, he does, he wants Barack Obama off the planet. But he can't say it on the air. Because that would be a hate too far for him. So instead, he speaks to his little scrape-knuckle audience in the code that they can understand. Just like his audience understands what he's talking about when he calls Rahm Emanuel a ballerina. Just like they understood what he was talking about when he called John Edwards the brick girl. It's code.
It's very transparent code. I mean, and I hear what you're saying, like, you know, he really couldn't, I don't know what other thing he could say other than wants him to fail or he's an enemy of the country, which is pretty much the kinds of things that, you know, the Republicans have been yammering about. Is, you know, they talk, oh, he's the enemy of the country and he's going to destroy the country and this is not what we want and this is this and this and this. And they just have such a detachment from reality that, yeah, we have dinos that have on our side that have done some pretty stupid things. But, you know, I mean, what's going to wind up happening is, you know, everybody's going to have to, you know, come into a reality where the middle round is that's going to have to be the right wing, because the right wing has completely lost their it's like soul paying time. I mean, this is like, you know, they've been racking up, you know, bad karma for years and years and years and years and years. All these things and all this hatred is just bubbling up inside them. You can't even contain it. It's crazy. It's just, I mean, imagine 4 years ago. Do you think that they'd be in the place that they were now? Back when Ari Fleischer could sit there and tell straight-faced, bold lies while our worst paranoias of, you know, federal government overstepping its boundaries and all this other stuff and, you know, martial law and all these things. All this stuff is just right.
Yeah, why do you think the right wing has to talk about all this foolishness? Because you know what? That story, which is in the stack for tonight, thank you for bringing it up. Everything that we said that we were afraid of under the reign of dim leader, it was true. They really were planning to overturn our constitutional form of government. And now they've been caught. You know, I mean, the Obama administration released those memos.
Mm-hmm.
And now we know, we see, and while we scream, you know, while we holler about how, you know, we want them prosecuted, the American people know now what level of requirement, Albert, what level of duty attaches to the American people ourselves in the face of knowledge that George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, that whole filthy fascist crowd was bent on trying, and we, my God, we were in a hair's breadth of it happening.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What level of responsibility attaches to us if we do not run these people to earth and prosecute and detain and imprison them?
Exactly. Oh, it's exactly right. I mean, I really don't. I don't even think it's like such a big blow. What just transpired, was it Friday? Was when we found out about this. I think it's been such a big blow, and there has been so much other, you know, Twitter fluff and all this other stuff. Even though, granted, you got to get it this far. The Twitter fluff that's out there now is a lot more pertaining to our reality. I mean, at least I'm not seeing anything about Kevin Federline and Britney Spears and all this other junk, whereas we didn't, you know, back when Bush first came to office and all the kind of, you know, fluff in the media and the whole, you know, celebrity worship type culture that we had going. I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's a little bit of that, but, you know, I think it's primarily issues. I mean, you know, as Sophie did mention in terms to Mark's show last hour that, you know, she's sick of hearing about Rush Limbaugh, but my goodness gracious, at least this cockroach is out of the shadows. He's out of the darkness. We can sit there, find him, and go, and get rid, I mean, and literally say, look at this. This is what you want to, this is where you want to go. This is where we're going. I mean, look at what happened over this weekend. Where the stock market's dropping like a, you know, like a meteor out of space. And, you know, who's responsible for this? Phil Graham and all these other criminals. What did Bush and these guys do? Oh my God, they're trying to overthrow the government, and then all their buddies are sitting there stealing and, you know, making, just eroding the culture like a freaking termites, you know, to the, a wooden foundation of a building. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know, I mean, the way the level, I think the level of crime hasn't even been comprehended. It's so big.
No, this is tip of the iceberg stuff, Albert.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Bush, George Bush's name will be a boogeyman in 400 years. He would be, I mean, especially if we don't do anything and we just sit there and allow it to continue and then, you know, revert back to the dark ages for another third or fourth time. If we're going to do that as a civilization, then, well, you know, he would certainly be a boogeyman in that, you know, for the future. But, you know, hopefully we will sit there and go, oh my God, we do some fixing. And we do some, you know, I mean, I loved your video, your song that you wrote. That was, you know, I'll never hear that song again without thinking about that and the chorus and however, and all the lyrics that you put into that song. I mean, that song is never again what it used to be to me. Talking about Country Road.
Yeah.
You know, just fantastic stuff. And I mean, just, you know, like I think that such a, you know, video like that has such a soul to it that, you know, maybe wasn't even alive and, you know, for a massive consumption, you know, in 2001. You know, I think that, you know, people are not going to want to, you know, people that don't know, and that's the whole thing, you know, people that we start waking up, we don't know what's going on in West Virginia. You know, we don't pay attention because it's so we don't pay it, you know. I mean, you look at where I live, you know, the big city near me is 30 miles away, I mean, 30 minutes away, and they act like it's, you know, across the country to come visit, you know. But, you know, I think that we're starting to kind of open our eyes to this, you know, local food. You'd never believe the amount of people that I talk to about these things that I don't think would have even cared about these things in 2001. And all of a sudden, people start caring about this kind of stuff. You know, if they're going to care about the food they're going to eat locally, then they're going to care about the air they breathe and the water they drink and with the land that they have to look at and raise children on and this and this and that. And I mean, I don't see no future in clean coal and these guys. And I mean, you can't carbon capture, such a freaking fantasy. I mean, if we had that kind of technology, we wouldn't have to worry about creating kind of, you know what I'm saying? If we had ability to stick carbon into something that was useful or benign, and then we would have no problem. We could be going to different planets in space. I mean, that's the kind of technology we'd need to have. What are you going to do? Get a straw out to space and pump it up out of the big smokestack? Oh, what a character that would be, huh? Oh my God!
I know.
And with a green, black cloud around it, and pipes coming out of it, blowing off more stuff. Ridiculous.
Right. Yeah. With the never mind the elevator to space. We've got to build the smokestack to space. But then, what happens to the smoke in a zero G environment? And you know what? I'll find out. Somebody will tell me. I bet you.
It'll make the atmosphere a little bigger. And we'll probably see bigger electrical storms. It'll be awesome. No, I mean, you know. I mean,
we'll start looking like Usel's homeworld.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have those. And kosher salt is delicious, by the way.
That's all we use. I mean, because, yeah.
It's not, just to explain to nobody who, someone who doesn't know, if you have like the iodized table salt, it's too salty. The kosher salt is like the right amount of salt for some reason. It's not as sharp, it's not as, you can overdo it, but for the most part, it's, yeah, that's the stuff to use. What the hell are they talking? Well, it's to me, I would.
But no, it's Wednesday and it's prayer meeting and it's an opportunity to fleece the faithful.
It's like I would imagine that the kosher way of making salt that comes in my box of kosher salt is process to it. I mean, not that it's blessed or anything. And since when are these people throwing out? When are fundies throwing out the Old Testament? I mean, if it's kosher, isn't that Christian? And this, they don't even know where the hell they are. They're so lost and scatterbrained. I mean, it's ridiculous. The fights that they're having, they're talking about, I read a really disturbing comment on somebody talking about, we won Prop 8, blah, 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 blah. The Colorado congressman. Did you happen to hear that cretin? That religious.
Which there was a guy in Utah and then there was a guy in Colorado and they both equally hateful and insane. And yeah, and what? Yeah, the Colorado guy. What was he? Was being gay? Was it an abomination for him or was it a sin against God? I can't remember. There's so many.
Who you're making me think of? You're making me think of that other guy. You said abomination, and it made me think of that reverend from Harlem.
Oh, yeah, the one that went after me.
He's calling Obama the next Hitler.
Oh, he hasn't gone away yet? Nobody told him his 15 minutes were up?
No. He's talking about how he's gay. Because it was that Larry Sinclair stuff's coming now. Remember, we talked about that?
Yeah.
I can't believe they waited so long, but it's here. So, yay, Larry's here, and he's on the news, and we'll see what happens with this. Most likely it's just going to be laughed at because it's so frickin' desperate. It's like socialist. What are they calling? They call him radical liberal. No, that didn't work. Oh, you socialist. Oh, that didn't work.
But that's okay. Jim Cramer's out on CNBC now talking about the President Obama and waving around a picture of Lenin.
How many times can you be caught? And I'm just using this as a general symbolism for these people. How many times can the banker get caught with his hand in the frickin' jar, and then they assume that every time we play Monopoly every day, that they're going to still be in charge? I don't even know why people in charge. I mean, the people that, Rush Limbaugh likes to talk about, quirking Michael Savage talking over here about, liberalism is a mental disorder, and Jonah Goldberg rewriting history and just contaminating filth and all this other junk that it does stick to some of the dullards among us and the greedy. But, when they sit there and they're talking about such nonsense, I don't know. It gives me a freaking aneurysm. It just gives me an aneurysm to sit there and imagine the crap that these people are trying. It's ridiculous. I'm sorry.
Well, it is a crime, and there's nothing more ridiculous to get back to one of the other topics you raised. At what point in time does some bar organization in this country make sure that John Yoo never gets to lawyer again?
Let's
establish the standard first. Bill Clinton lied about consensual oral sex and was disbarred for it. John Yoo, on the other hand, lied about the meaning of the Constitution of the United States and actively advocated for the abrogation of the entire Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a constitutional law scholar at Bolt Hall School of Law on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley.
Yeah, which
is why does that man have a law license, Albert?
You know, he might have a law license, but I don't really think he has a single ounce of respect. I mean, I don't think he has a drop. I don't think he has an iota. I mean,
listen to his words. This is a quote.
No, he's a filthy degenerate. He's a hideous person.
Anybody who would write this is. First Amendment speech and press rights may also be subordinated to the overriding need to wage war successfully. He further advocated that the Fourth Amendment would not apply in domestic military operations that were in themselves in violation of the Posse Comitatus Act.
Mm-hmm.
This man, you know, granted, he looks like he probably bathes daily and all those important things. This man is a monster. This man, it is obvious from his legal so-called analysis that inside this man's skull lay the seeds itching to sprout of genocides and crimes against humanity, of tyranny and dictatorship, of everything that this country stands against. That man stands for, and the state, and he's licensed in Pennsylvania, and the state of Pennsylvania still allows him to besmirch its legal licensing process by holding a law license when this man was absolutely advocating in places where it mattered, Albert, advocating the complete overthrow of the Constitution of the United States.
Yep, and the shredding of the Declaration of Independence and all that jazz. And he wanted to make Bush a little puppet, dictator, and he's a Goebbels. I mean, and he may not have been writing, probably, but he's sitting there paving the way. He's an Eichmann or whatever you want to call him. He's one of these kind of, little evil, banality of evil kind of people. That
little Eichmann. And,
exactly. I mean, he sits there and does these things. And, I mean, he's maybe a little bit more malicious. He really kind of, I think he wants some blood. But, I mean, I don't think for long that people like him will be able to practice. I mean, when they talk about ethics, this is the thing that blows my mind. When you talk about ethics, okay, now I know ethics, there's a huge difference between, being ethical and being moral. Okay, but ethics are bigger than morality, and ethics are even more all-encompassing. And if upholding the chief main law, the Constitution, all right? I understand. You said that there's the Constitution. It's you can fit it all on one really big page, And if you want to break it down into a book, it's what, 40 pages? Those little booklets, whatever they are.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then you look at, the law books, and there's case law and this and that, but then there's all these penal laws, and then law gets into this, just mountains of books. And, I'm sure any lawyer can tell you, I got friends that are going in San Francisco, going to law school right now. And so that's all she does, is read these books, read these laws, all these things. Now, if they're going to sit there, right, if the Constitution is the main law, how the hell are you going to try to sit there and try to find some clause or here and there and this and this and some vague nonsense so you can sit there and try to... I don't even know where he tried to justify this. I mean, obviously some was absolutely 100% wrong and they shouldn't have done it because they went out and, nobody pay attention to this memo. No, nobody looked behind the curtain at this memo, right? Remember? Didn't they just do that like 3 days before Bush is out of office? They sat there and they made that memos and his little additions. They said, "Oh no, nobody pay attention. Like we never did any of this. It was all a dream. This didn't happen. These are not the droids you're looking for." And that's essentially this nonsense that these guys try to throw up this flack. I don't think it's effective. I don't think it's going to work. I think people are too awake, too consciously aware of maybe, oh my God, are you really telling me that there was some justification to my fear? That little twing that I felt in my stomach every time I heard talking about this kind of system you know, closed circuit cameras being put in, or, you know, fences and all these other components to, you know, these little things. Oh my God, I had something to really worry about. I'm not just some tinfoil hat conspiracy theory because I'm worried about these approaches I'm seeing.
Scott Horton, who turns out is an excellent, excellent writer, by the way, has an article over at Harper's. And it's really a good analysis. It's called George W. Bush's Disposable Constitution. I recommend it for anyone who is so inclined. Harpers.org, and then just it was published yesterday. He has one line in there that just gives me the chills. He says, "We may not have realized it at the time, but in the period from late 2001 to January 19th, 2009, this country was a dictatorship." It was. And see, this puts paid to one other thing, Albert, and that is this. You know how the right-wingers were running around, and some of them still, well, see, we don't know how many attacks George Bush protected us against. Remember that? You've heard that.
Yeah.
Well, this proves that that number is precisely zero. That there were no attempts. Not that there were no. Not that they stymied it. There were no attempts.
If
to the extent that he wanted it, Osama bin Laden got everything that he wanted, Albert.
Exactly. Well, exactly. But then so did the Bush administration.
Because if there had been an attack, All of this would have been put into play.
It would have, but I don't know if they'd want to take it. I mean, in a sense, you know, now we're going to have to talk about who does what and who tells, you know, who knows what when, you know, what when and where. You know, I mean, if you think about it, okay, Osama bin Laden is an independent entity, all right? Well, it doesn't make tactical sense to continue to try to throw, you know, these little squads of men do these things that are, you know, obviously create miracles. You know that kind of thing for the kind of retaliation that he got exactly what he wanted. But Osama bin Laden wanted, what did he want? He wanted U.S. forces out of Saudi Arabia. He wanted to get us mired in a war on two fronts or something along those lines, invade another Arab nation. And then what was the third one? There was another one. You know, yeah, basically, you know, bring its economy to its knees, which is why the towers were symbolically attacked. Okay. So he got every single one. Osama bin Laden, I bet he can get some stuff done as president. Because you look at what he's doing from a cave. My God. I mean, how the hell does anyone fall into a trap that,
I know.
Kind of times you ever make a blunder like that is when you set it yourself and you walk into your own claymore or your own needle in the carpet. I mean, I've done that. Stupid idiot. These guys.
Cocktail toothpicks are hell, too, by the way. Let me just say that.
Yeah. No doubt.
They break off. Little tiny punji sticks in the shag. Yuck.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I know exactly what you're saying, Albert. And you know, the other thing to be borne in mind is that right after September 11th, you know, bin Laden put out a little memo saying, "Get the hell off of my sacred sand." Talking about Saudi Arabia. George Bush promptly complied, and he never hit us again.
No. And then that's if you want to talk about, you know, he's an independent entity. If he's not, then I think in a sense, you know, I think it's quite possible that, yeah, you know, they write up all these laws, and what I would like to see, you know, prosecutions and, like, I don't know, could you call it book burnings? You know, because all these law books and these law theses and all these things that are just hideous.
I know what you're talking about.
Can we burn those?
No,
yeah.
Let me suggest.
Erase them.
Let me suggest that we not. Let me suggest that we carve them in bronze.
Okay, yeah.
Okay?
That or that.
And
that we
mount them on the walls of the penitentiary where we put these monsters. Okay, because the thing that there's one thing at work here, and it's kind of, you know how the people who are always in favor of the death penalty are saying, well, you know, it certainly discourages murder, that death penalty. He'll never kill again. Now, before any of the little lurking right wingers flip out, I'm not advocating executing John Yoo. I don't advocate executing anybody. However,
he has to go to trial first.
Right.
Let's not sentence him yet till we really discover all the things he's done.
But yeah, exactly. The point that I'm making, however, is that this, if we do not prosecute a monster like John Yoo, that we then leave these arguments of his floating around in the universe, for want of a better phrase. And somewhere down the road, some other little right-wing lawyer is going to pick it up and say, well, look, they didn't do anything to him for advocating this. That must mean we can.
Yeah, I mean, you know what, essentially that, they're like cleaning up these close coal slurry pits and, you know, getting the air and water clean and, you know, doing these things are important for future generations. Well, so is cleaning up this mind pollution, this depraved, you know, fascist type mentality, that kind of stuff, and leaving that stuff around is just as toxic as depleted uranium. You know, and that kind of stuff will impact you far more directly and every day, you know, feeling the boot in your face kind of way. You know, because if you think about it, you know, humanity is only going to get bigger and bigger, which means that the people that are going to be in charge are the ones that they're going to want to be able to control tighter and tighter. So if we allow these little, you know, Laputians to put these ropes around us, you know, as we start waking up, you know, it's our own damn fault in 60 years when, you know, everybody has a number codes on their freaking foreheads and, you know, buying creds and eating red bennies and, you know, bars and jets and cars and all this other crap. You know, if we'll be lucky to see a demolition man future or, you know, running man or any of those other crappy future.
I am the law.
Exactly. I mean, you know, and I'll tell you what, you know, as corny as some of those movies are, as corny as some of John Carpenter's movies are, they're scary because they're kind of accurate too. You know, you sit there and you watch Escape from New York and you see the background to what that movie's set in. You know, you look at the Escape from LA and everybody hated that movie, but if you look at that movie and the background that it's in and what the country looks like, there's a theocratic takeover of the freaking government. The president is now president for life. People are put when they're desirables, they're put into Los Angeles and New York into these Waldorf places. If they try to leave, they get killed. You know, if you sit there and you look at that, you know, people don't, I don't think, really take the whole movie and they go, oh, yeah, there's Kurt Russell surfing on a wave, you know, on a tidal wave, whatever the hell he's doing. I mean, you know, that's what they see with the movie. And they go, oh, look, he's got a cool gun and, you know, this and that. But, you know, the reality to the movie is, you know, is far more, you know, look around.
Go watch Blade Runner.
Go watch Blade. Oh, watch all those. You know, not for nothing. I thought Arnold Schwarzenegger, he always disappointed me when I heard these things about him being a right winger and a not. I always thought he knew better. They're like, dude, didn't you read the plots to your own movies? Like, you know, what's wrong with you? I mean,
I only say the lines they tell me to say. I do not read the rest of the script. It is not in my contract.
Seriously, man. I mean, come on now. It's ridiculous.
Well, no. Look, the New York Times article and the Scott Horton article at Harper's, all of this stuff about you, is terrifying. It really is. I mean, it is terrifying. I mean, this is John Carpenter movie stuff. It really, really is, Albert. Because
exactly.
I mean, you know, well, a few minutes ago in our conversation, I mentioned the Posse Comitatus Act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that says that the military of the United States can never be used for law enforcement purposes inside the United States. Okay? Now, to me and you, that says you can't unleash the American military on the American people. Right? I mean, that's fairly obvious.
It also says to me, I remember as a kid, I remember this actually striking me as something that made me love this country was when they told me about, you know, and you couldn't, because I grew up in New England, which obviously was, you know, headquartered and, I mean, you know, by all the, you know, British troops and stuff like that. So they kind of were subjugated in the ways that they were. And so they made the laws to counteract, like, oh my God, that really sucked. We don't want to ever have to do that ever again. Troops are not allowed to be bunked in people's houses. They can't just, you know, go in and garrison themselves in there. And, you know, they can't be cops because it was, right? That's kind of what sparked the Revolutionary War was when those soldiers shot that black man in Boston.
Crispus and Cox. Yes.
Exactly. And that pissed people off. And, you know, so in a way, you don't want that. What happened at Kent State? You know, and I know that the National Guard is, especially then, was technically a state thing, but look what happened. You know, that's what happens, man, when you give people, you know, 18-year-olds a gun and you tell them, no, these are enemies of the state, you know, and then you know, there might be terrorists in there. And,
well, okay, you know. So we've got a rational understanding of posse comitatus, which comes around at the end of the 19th century as a result of the abuses that happened during Reconstruction in the South. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you and I, we have just established a rational understanding of posse comitatus. Can't use law enforcement. Can't use the military as law enforcement against the American people.
Right.
That's kind of what it says. Well, people like John Yoo, however, looked at posse comitatus. You want to know what they saw? I mean, this really is. I don't know. This is what happens when you do meth and law at the same time or something. I don't know. But they saw posse comitatus, and John Yoo argued that because the military would be engaged in fighting terrorism,
yep,
and that they were carrying out raids on terrorist cells and seizing property and so forth.
It was a war on terrorism.
Right. Well, they said that posse comitatus would pose no obstacle. This is the language from the New York Times. Would pose no obstacle to the use of troops in a domestic fight against terrorism suspects. Mm-hmm. And this was their reasoning. Because the troops are being used as national security, they aren't police. And therefore, therefore, posse, dig this. I mean, this is really, really important.
Yeah.
Posse comitatus doesn't even apply. You know, this is from the same mind that gave us, if it doesn't cause significant organ failure or death, it ain't torture.
Well, and neither is crushing the testicles of a 6-year-old child.
Right.
If the president finds a need to do so. I mean, he's a sick, sick puppy. I mean, he's a sick, sick bastard. And to sit there and to let that slide, I mean, he makes all these other guys, you know, that these villains throughout history, in our recent history, he makes them look like jokes. I mean, like Nixon would have never done the things that Bush has done and that you enabled Bush to do. And, you know, and to sit there and try to say that, you know, Bush has his name attached to this, doesn't he? I mean, this is his legal counsel. He has, you know, and he enacted these policies. He sat there and signed up statements regarding the fact and executive orders and all these other things. So, yeah, granted, you know, he didn't declare martial law. He didn't suspend elections. He didn't, you know, he didn't wind up doing a few of these things. I mean, they were certainly...
But they were thinking about it.
Oh, they were planning it. And the whole thing is... Well, what is a conspiracy? You know, you don't have to rank in order to be, you know, but if you're caught with blueprints and, you know, security codes and there's a group of you in there and you got weapons and shaped charges, your ass is going to probably jail for, you know, something.
And this is the other important thing. Eric Holder, the attorney general, gave a speech, and I still have concerns about him and his ties to Chiquita Banana and what went on in Colombia. You know, no passes.
No, but he points for the med raids, but that's another thing.
Right, but he said... shortly before the memos were released, the day before yesterday, he said, too often over the past decade, the fight against terrorism has been viewed as a zero-sum battle with our civil liberties. Not only is that thought misguided, I fear that in actuality it does more harm than good. And then, and there's meaning behind this, he said that the memos were being released in light of a substantial public interest in the issue.
Yeah.
In other words, he said, I'm giving them to you. Now, you make us prosecute these bastards.
Yeah, exactly.
Here it is. Here's the evidence. Analyze the evidence. Now, get in the streets. March. Tell us to prosecute these people. Give us the popular support that we need to go into the Bolt Hall School of Law and drag that hateful, fascist, tyrannical little bastard out by his heels in chains and go and put him on trial.
Oh, praise the Lord on that one. Praise the Lord.
And that's the nature of my initial inquiry, Albert.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is the level of responsibility, now that we've got this stuff in our hands, what level of responsibility attaches to the American people?
Mm-hmm.
Not yelling at you, you understand.
No, I feel you.
I was out in some freezing damn cold Monday. And you know what? My fingertips are still a little bit funky from the cold.
I hate that.
But I had no choice. Ferg had done something with my gloves that I didn't find out until couldn't find them. And I had a microphone in my hand in my little gizmo box, so they were exposed flesh. And I was out in that for several hours. And you know what? I'd be more than happy to stand in freezing cold or blazing heat. I'd be more than happy to stand with millions, Albert, to demand the prosecution of the Bradburys and the Bibbies and the John Hughes and David Addington and George Bush and Dick Cheney. Date and time, and I'll find a way to be there. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, it's very important. I mean, it's also, in a sense, on the same breath, it's important for, you know, yeah, we're going to have to push them, and that's without a doubt. However, they're still going to have to do it, or they're going to become just as popular as Bush is. You know, they're not going to be able to, I mean, there's going to have to be a pretty damn big lollipop out there for us to be distracted that much. I mean, you really got to think that there's no way they're just going to be able to get away with little things. This is why I think that, you know, we're starting to hear about these investigations that, you know, kind of have been going on, and they're going to put up their recommendations, and I think that's why you're kind of hearing Nancy Pelosi change her tune a little bit, and yeah, we'll probably see some, you know, some CYA, you know, here and there, but I think we're going to see some justice. I think we're going to see some more, you know, he wants to, you know, I mean, you know, that's the thing. Obama talked about hope, and he'll talk about, you know, transparency. Well, if you think about that, transparency is a huge step forward. I mean, I remember talking to you when I first...
So is Pat Leahy calling for a truth commission, although that doesn't contain an element of prosecution. I want prosecution. I want John Yoo to play Parcheesi with the Unabomber for the rest of his days.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have to see. We'll have to see if Mr. I Can't Get a Job Gonzalez is going to, you know, do the conservative thing and cover his butt, and, you know, we'll see what he does with Bush. And, you know, he said he was going to cooperate. Didn't he say something along those lines? I mean, maybe I was dreaming, but, you know, I'm pretty sure I heard that Gonzalez said he would cooperate, you know, for a deal, naturally. But, I mean, he's another one. And you know, we got to also, who else do we got to get? We got to go get Mr. Let the Eagles Soar. We got to go get him. He's another one.
Ashcroft, yes.
Oh, boy. And I think, you know, I think it's kind of important that, you know, I don't think we're going to lose track of this kind of stuff. I think that, in a way, maybe with these issues and dealing with the severity of them and, you know, actually getting this stuff handled will be our new celebrity culturally, you know, religion for a while. I think it's going to be the salve that's going to, you know, soothe us when in this painful year. 2009 is going to be pretty rough. 2010 could be worse, you know, and, you know, I think people are just starting to barely feel it now. And I don't say barely, some people are severely feeling, you know, the situation that we're in. And, you know, I don't see anything that the Republicans have said or done to, you know, all I hear them doing is, you can't take these billionaires' money, you can't do this, you can't do that, and they just want to protect the guys who write their paychecks. It's so obvious. It's just, I mean, it's, you know, this transparency is, I think you can also see who's lying to you and who's telling you the truth. I think it's, that's why people are talking about Rush Limbaugh. That's why we're talking about you. I mean, you saw this. I remember talking to you about what you said.
This gets a little confusing, doesn't it?
It does, though.
Talking to you about you. Yeah, every penny of it.
It's Seussian. But, I remember talking to that, and, you know, we have known, and now more people are going to know, and now more people are going to know. And once they all know what we know, you know, and once they realize...
Once they know we know, they know we know?
Exactly. And I mean, you know, you gotta take, you know, there's something about knowing that makes you feel like you have to do something. And if you didn't know, and now you know you got to do something. And one of the things you got to do is talk about it with other people. And by talking about it, it's going to make more and more people know. And the more people know, the more people know. And now we're all going to know about you. We're all going to know about Bush. We're all going to know about all these other creeps and criminals. And we're going to want to do something about it because we're going to see directly where it's impacted our lives to such an extent. I mean, you know, I understand how Americans, you know, don't understand what that, you know, and they hear, you know, some people get offended. You know, I don't care what the rest of the world thinks about America. This is America. They can kiss my ass, blah, blah, blah. You know, I think they don't understand that because they don't realize, oh, you're not supposed to be in a fancy restaurant when you fly down. You know, like, they don't understand enough to be embarrassed. And I think that they're starting to really kind of start to understand that, man, wow, that is that what that feeling is? It's embarrassing. It's shame. To be humiliated like this on the world stage and to now to start to see it. And, you know, when, wow, man, you're going to see. You see, let spring come. The snow is starting to thaw. It's symbolic to, I'm telling you.
My fingers are starting to thaw.
Yeah, fingers are starting to thaw. People are starting to open their eyes. They're looking around, you know, and it's, you know, this is a big mess. And we've been calling it, and they talk, oh, liberals wanted Bush to fail.
Wow. Yeah, that's one of those that ran through me like a dose of salts, Albert. You know, I didn't have to want Bush to fail.
No.
I knew the man's history, okay? I knew, from the potty training at gunpoint by that hateful old beast to them going and playing golf the day that they planted his baby sister, Robin. It went on and up to, you know, the frogs with the M80s and throwing baseballs and tennis rackets at his friends, to the whole academic thing and the Texas Air National Guard, Harkin Energy, Arbustos, Spectrum 7, the Texas Rangers, all of that. I didn't have to want him to fail. I didn't want him to fail. I don't think I've ever wanted a president to fail. Because when Republicans fail, Albert, you know, when Republicans fail, the rich don't take it on the chin. You and me do.
Oh, true, but I think that Bush did fail.
Well, he did. That's the point. I didn't have to want him to. I knew he was gonna.
Well, true. And I'm just trying to say in my own way that, yeah, I wanted him to fail because I knew a lot of the things that he was doing was very wrong. Like this John Yoo memos and torture and all this other, and starting wars of aggression and lying about weapons of mass destruction. You bet. Now, did I want, you know, what do you mean fail? Well, how are we going to describe failure? Failure is everybody seeing how wrong he was and this country not having a Bush doctrine to speak of ever again. To never allow the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and to not arrest people for wearing a T-shirt. You know, like all the things that I mean, and then some that have gone down in the past 8 years, all those things that he did and he stood for, you bet I wanted him to fail. Because I got to say I did, because it was wrong. It was wrong in every way that it's apparent now. I mean, it was one of those things. Now, did I want him to collapse Social Security? Did I want him to do all these things that would, you know, like lessen restrictions on banks and lessen restrictions on the amount of companies and different establishments a media, you know, conglomerate can own in a city? No, that kind of stuff. Those are things you as a president, you want them to uphold your rights and this and that. You don't want him to destroy the economy, but you could see where he was going to. I mean, to sit there and put $2 trillion, though, twice the cost of World War II is what Iraq is going to cost, twice. Once you hear that, you realize that it's not going to be a sustainable thing. And it's not that you want him to fail. It's just, you know, it's going to fail. Driving a truck into a wall. You know, I mean, I can't believe the audacity these people have. You know, look at the wreck that we just had, and they're over here talking about how it's not their fault. I mean, who the hell's been in charge? I mean, you guys have been in charge. Oh, the Democrat Congress. Well, you know how slow the Congress is, number one. But number two, there was Bushies and Republicans and, oh my God, they've been in charge for the last 20 years. And a lot of this stuff has momentum to it that we don't feel it till later. And so, you know, I hope that that's, you know, I don't want Obama to fail in the respect of, do I want him to fail upholding these just miserable things of that presidents have been tied into? Yeah, there are things that I think I want Obama to fail on, you bet. I don't think it's I don't think it's a detriment to being a patriot, okay? But to sit there and say I want the president to fail the way the Obama hater Rush Limbaugh says it, you know, I mean, it's a entirely different thing because he wants them to fail and government to go bankrupt so him and his buddies can continue their, you know, feeding frenzies, which is what they'd have. They're the ones with all the gold, remember? That's why they all them commercials for them guys, eh? I wonder how many of these get off in, what's that other dude? Stafford or Stanford. I wonder how many of these Republicans are licking their wounds from these two.
That, you know, that's one of those things that's going to take a while to come out.
But out
it will, and everyone, all of these things are going to come home to roost at the doorstep of greed.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, are we the only ones that ever heard that? If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Brother. Hey, Albert, I'm going to roll along, brother, but awful good to talk to you, my friend. I thought about you and thought about a lot of other people as we were walking around D.C., and walk around D.C. we did. We're still working on some of the technical angles, but we'll get them all licked. You know, if anybody can do it, we can. And we got it partially licked, but we're still working on stuff. But it was a pleasure talking with you this evening, and please know, and everybody else know, that anytime we go anywhere, you know, Agnes and me are sitting there looking, hey, you know, wonder what Albert would think. Look at that, you know, he sure did. And we do. That's the cool, fun part about all of this. So have a great night. Are you beginning to thaw or warm up a little bit? It's March, you know. I don't know what March in Wisconsin's all about.
Yes, sir. I couldn't believe how much snow is missing from my yard. I can see grass and there's a little couple puddles of water, and you know there's more wildlife out there. Not negative. I think it's only, I don't even know where it's at. It's probably like 20 degrees over here right now, but that it was enough. It was sunny enough, the sun's high enough that it's starting to melt and we're starting to thaw out, and I think this is going to be a good spring.
Yeah, well, I think the March the 1st qualified as in like a lion, so hopefully we get out like a lamb. Albert, take care, brother.
All right, brother. Be good.
Bye. All right. Bye now. Calling from Wisconsin, our buddy Albert. And I'm going to take a little break and then come back to the phone. Promise. I promise. I promised you some tunage from this album, and it's gorgeous. Go buy this. Own this. I bought the download via Amazon, and it was not terribly expensive at all. This is worth your money. Jason Isbell and the 400 unit. In light of what Albert and I were just talking about, this is the perfect bumper. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn.
Yeah. It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
The title of that track, However Long, again, the album, Jason Isbell, Isbell, and the 400 unit. That song's got real anthem possibility. However long the dawn will break again. That's where we are now. Trying to break the dawn. That's what exposing the evil of John Yoo and folks like him is about. The cleansing, sanitizing effect of sunlight. And there's 11 tracks on the album. It is a bargain. I can't emphasize enough. Get this. Get this. You will not regret it. And as an independent artist, I have no doubt whatsoever that every sale means something to Jason Isbell and his band, the 400 unit. Let's go to the phones. Susan is with us from Columbia City, Oregon. Hey, Susan.
Hi there.
How are you?
Oh, hanging in there. I do have to disagree with you.
On what level? Or on what topic?
You said earlier that George Bush, you know, his claim to protecting us from attacks was bogus. There were no attacks. You missed one.
Which?
The one where he executed a coup d'etat.
Well, yeah, right. But they weren't counting those either, so yeah.
Yeah, let's face it. He turned his country into a dictatorship nobody even noticed.
Well, I don't think that's fair now, is it, Susan? We noticed. A lot of people noticed. It was the do something about it part that was kind of tough. You know,
that's why
impeachment's off the table, that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I am so pleased to hear Pelosi say she's not really in agreement with the commission for the specific reason because you don't get to prosecute. She was a prosecutor. I can go with that.
Yeah, I can. Look, it would have been nice to have stopped it in mid. And you know what? Now we've got the ammunition. Now the next time some right winger says, because I heard it, God, I heard it. Oh, I heard it so many times. Well, where's all these abuses y'all said were going to happen? Where are they? Come on. He hadn't done nothing. He's just the president.
Uh-huh. Right.
Well, now we've got the documentary evidence that they were sitting around yearning, sweating, aching for something to happen so that they could grind the American people and our constitutional form of government beneath their nasty hobnailed boots.
For those, I have a tinfoil hat moment for you. Has it occurred to you that the reason why the economy was allowed to, who knows, maybe it was given a few discreet shoves, was strictly to force people to the point of desperation. And desperate people will do desperate things, like rebel. You got a rebellion? Martial law.
Yeah, and I hope the significance of that argument was not lost. They didn't argue that it was okay to do it within the framework of posse comitatus. They said it didn't apply. You know, just like the stream buffer zone rule didn't apply to mountaintop removal toxins. Didn't apply.
Two things that bothers me about the way they did the posse comitatus. First of all, I think they had a fallback position. Think Blackwater.
Sure. Well, you know, those camps and all the barbed wire fences that were documented.
Yeah, because a lot of those mercenaries that they were using in Iraq were from outside of the country that were former guest squad members, so on and so forth, they would have no compunction about firing on the citizens of the United States. Not in the least. Wouldn't bother them in the least.
Mm-hmm. See? Yeah.
And here's something that really bothers me, and I have not seen, I haven't even seen Rachel Maddow say anything, and it just bugs me to death. She gets Jonathan Turley on and say, and even Jonathan doesn't say anything about it. She gets Jonathan Turley and says, okay, what do we do to get rid of this, to make sure it can't happen? Okay, I'm sitting there yelling the obvious answer. They go right on by. My obvious answer? Repeal the Military Commissions Act!
It would seem obvious, wouldn't it?
Nobody says a word. Duh!
Yeah, it's another one of those cricket moments.
Yeah, and I'm going, And, you know, finally, Bobby's getting to the point where he gets really mad when I start screaming stuff that, because it's always the same thing. They just, it's like that law just kind of skated right on past.
And
did they even read it?
That's an open question.
Okay, I read it. Which was a pain in the arse right there.
Oh, and by the way, this just hitting. John Yoo, whom we've been talking about,
yeah,
was asked in an interview with the Orange County Register. Now, you know, Orange County, California, you know, bastion of
conservative.
Yeah. They interviewed John Yoo, and the question was put to him: is there anything you would have done differently? What's his first answer?
No.
These memos I wrote were not for public consumption. They lack a certain. Wait. Yeah, somebody bring around the hummingbird tongue canapes, please.
Yeah.
They lack a certain polish, I think. Would have been better to explain government policy rather than try to give unvarnished, straight talk legal advice. I certainly would have done that differently, but I don't think I would have made the basic decisions differently. This hateful, vile creature still thinks that the Constitution of the United States, for which your and my and so many listeners to the horn and so many Americans' forebears have fought and bled and died, he thinks it's rubbish, Susan. Why is this man not in irons?
Yeah. I'm glad my father isn't. I'm glad my father's dead. I really am. He can't see this.
They asked him about inquiries at the Justice Department into the legality of his work, and he said, I wish they weren't doing it, but I understand why they are. I hope you understand, John Yoo. I hope you understand. I hope John Yoo understands that the reason they are is that there are people in the United States and in the Justice Department who think that he should be wearing an orange jumpsuit for the rest of his natural-born life.
Yes, and being the love slave of a big dude named Bubba.
No, I was thinking more Unabomber.
Well,
I want him in that maximum security. 2 hours of sunlight a day, you know, solitary supermax kind of lockdown. Because I don't want anybody to ever get the notion that you can argue that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply, that you can argue that Posse Comitatus simply doesn't apply, that you can argue that the First Amendment can be subjugated to the whim of an ignorant president. I don't want everybody, and I don't want anybody ever again, Susan, to think that they can get away with making that argument.
Well, I would much prefer to see the whole crew of them, rather than being prosecuted here, I would much prefer to see the investigation here and handed over all of the evidence and the people handed over to The Hague. You know why?
Why is that?
Because the very first Republican president that gets into office is going to pardon them if they're tried and imprisoned here. If they're sitting on their butts in The Hague, there is no pardon.
Well, I just looked up, because this is what I would like to see him prosecuted under. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies. This is Article 3, Section 3 of the United States Constitution, which John Yoo despises. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Well, when you try to dismantle our constitutional form of government, and in light of what our so-called enemies said, how is that not giving them aid and comfort, Susan?
That would be a stretch.
No, that's not a stretch at all. It aided, it materially aided and comforted Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden. When John Yoo sought to materially alter the constitutional form of government of this nation in response to their goading or attacks.
Yeah, I have to give you that, because what they did was the best recruiting tool that Al-Qaeda ever had. So in a way, I guess you could consider that aid and abetting and aid and comfort.
Consider that Congress shall have the power to declare the punishment of treason, but no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except during the life of the person attainted. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court. There's some stuff that comes to play here. This interview with the Orange County reporter, register, whatever, what have you.
Yeah, he just opened his yap and hung himself.
That certainly looks like a confession to me.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have made the basic decisions differently.
And if you're going to put him up for treason, you have to put up George and Dick. And
well, that's the thing. You put Addington and Bibby and that dirty crowd up on charges of treason, and you go to them and say, "Well, fellas, you know what the punishment for treason is, right?"
Yep.
Now, we can go forward, and you will be convicted, and you will be punished accordingly, unless you go work on your scales and come back and sing like a bird on the people who told you to come up with these decisions. Because we know what the decision-making process was in the Bush White House, Susan. Remember Richard Clark?
Mm-hmm.
Remember how after September the 11th, 2001, he was called to the White House by Bush and told to find a link between September 11th and Saddam Hussein? Not to find out who done it, but to find a link to Saddam Hussein. He came back and said there is no link, and Bush said go back and look again. The Downing Street memo, the facts were being fitted to the situation. What was that language? I've almost forgotten it now.
Cherry picking.
Well, but yeah, that's the term for it. These are concepts of treason.
Uh-huh. Oh, and that other thing that Bin Laden wanted us to do, by the way, was to get out of
Saudi Arabia.
No, it was Bin Sultan Air Base.
Which was in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, but I mean, give it back, give the base back to the Saudi government, which we did immediately.
Well, George was a coward. At heart, George is a coward, and he did what he was told.
Yeah, as soon as he did what he was told, no problem.
Yeah. Hey, Susan, I got to run on here, but the good points and good ideas, and good to talk to you. I'm glad to be back.
One other, real fast.
Sure.
Religious things. They have now come up with a heavenly blessed debt.
Debt?
You die, now they're going after your relatives, even if you have no estate.
Oi, send me that link,
blessed
would you?
Would be.
Yeah, send me that link. Take care, Susan. Bye now.
Okay, I will. Bye-bye.
Luke is with us from East Tennessee. Oh, we lost Luke. His battery was dying. Doggone it. Hate that for him. Well, let's see. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, good evening, Bob.
Hey, Ed, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I thought I would chime in with a couple items that I see. There probably is not as complicated as I've been here and there, but I just wanted to comment on jobs in the auto industry and this bailout. They made 15 million too many cars last year. They're not selling. They're sitting on the lots. So my question is, why in the tarnation are we bailing out companies that are making stuff at our expense and that it's not selling? Can you explain our way out of that one?
Well, I think those are two different topics, Ed. One is related to management and management-based decisions. You know, the working people, the people who are feeding families and putting kids through school and buying clothing and keeping the economy going to the extent that it's going. Their job was not to ask people or ask management, "Are you sure we need this many cars?" They were there and happy to be going to work every day,
mm-hmm.
and keeping their own little communities alive in the process. So, and then as the question as to why we're bailing them out, I don't like that phrase "too big to fail." I don't like that phrase "too big to fail."
Oh, okay.
But the fact of the matter is, in the state that the economy is in now, if we let GM and Chrysler sink beneath the waves, they'll take Ford with them, and they'll take the Japanese car makers who are in the United States as well. They'll take BMW and Mercedes who are in the United States too. While that good for nothing POS Richard Shelby down in Alabama was clucking and gleefully celebrating Detroit's problems and talking about, well, it was working for us down here with our Mercedes plant. That dummy didn't realize that Detroit going down will take the rest of the world's automakers with it.
Yeah.
So that's the short answer of why you can't just let it die.
Well, if you notice in all the other depressions, and it's like a girl when I was instructing classes, she said, "I don't mind paying $18 for a sweater, but said I'd like to make enough to buy it." So that's the same theory of flooding the market with products or whatever, that merchandise that is not going to be used.
Yeah, and of course, you know, if people have the money to do it, there's never been a better time to buy a car than right now.
Oh, I agree. In fact, we were looking, but that really don't get to the bottom of, I guess, the way I think, or, you know, what's the use of planting more apple trees if apples ain't selling?
No, I understand that, but by the same token, the fact that Detroit is said to have produced 15,000 too many cars, was it 15,000 too many cars when the economy wasn't soured? So, you know, it's a question, Ed, of whether or not it's 15,000 too many cars if people don't have the money to buy cars.
Not 15,000, 15 million.
I'm sorry, 15 million. My bad. It's 15 million too many if people don't have the money to buy them. And it also plays into questions of our so-called consumer culture. Now, Ed, I'm guessing, I'm pretty sure I'm right. You were raised in a time when you didn't waste anything.
That's exactly right.
Well, we, in the consumer culture that was deliberately foisted upon the people of the United States starting in the early 1950s, we created this notion that, you know, you were somehow socially tainted if you didn't have a new car every 5 years.
Well, that didn't bother how they tainted me. I'll manage my money, and I'm not. They can go out and buy. Well, you know, that's the craziest damn thing. That's the craziest thing I ever heard of at a time like this. Go out and spend your money? That's got to be the bottom of the bucket talking. I'd say you better hold on to some to...
If you've got any left, I mean, if for people who were playing in the stock market, whether they wanted to or were compelled to via their retirement systems, how do you hang on to what's left when it just keeps trying to dribble away?
Well, we caught ours before the big stuff hit. We still lost some, but not people's losing now. But I still don't agree with paying people for failure, and I fully realize, being a union man and being an ex-member of the United Auto Workers, I understand what you're saying, but how long do we spend before there is no more spending to be done?
There is a way around this, but it's going to take spending.
It's going to take what?
It's going to take spending. It's going to take wise spending. It seems to me it would be much more economic to buy General Motors and buy Chrysler at their par value, and then retool the auto industry from the inside out, and let the American people own those things until they can become financially viable, and let those companies buy their way back into privacy.
Well,
as opposed to just pumping money into them, because
you don't hear those kind of ideas, though. That's too innovative for.
No, you don't hear those ideas, Ed, because the right wing screams that's socialism.
Yeah, you know something? The first person that says socialism in my face, I'm gonna socialize him. And I mean it. That is so disgusting. When all of the CEOs and all of them now are going that way, you know, socialism's all right. It's for them. It's like Congress and the Senate. National health bill is real good for them, but that ain't so good for us. That's socialism. If it comes up, I don't give a dang what kind of name they tag it with. And they can call me anything they want to as long as I get me a check at the end of the week. That's the way I felt when I was working. And I think most people that's got any common sense use that approach. You know, yeah, maybe a little bit pink, maybe a little bit, off base, but I'm gonna stick with that theory that, you bring home the paycheck when you got a family to feed. So, but
go right ahead.
Do you have any response to that?
Go right ahead, Ed. It seems to me that working families deserve every bit as much regard as well-heeled Wall Street bankers.
Yeah,
and you know, we didn't sweat a whole lot bailing them out.
Yeah, well, I saw a thing years ago in a book, a little book, but using 9, 10, 11 pages. Secretary hanging, I think I told you this, hanging on the doorway, hollering at the senator, said, "Hurry up and go over to Naval Hospital to get your free examination and medicine, so you can come back and vote against the national health bill."
Yeah.
So that's you know what? That's been 40 years ago. I haven't forgot it then. If I live to be another 40 years old, I won't forget it. Because that really irks me that how even elected people that come out of the same mold as a lot of us come out of, some of them did, that they can get so high above where they come from. But I'll drop that, and I would like to give you an opinion, get an explanation on where I'm probably off base on this. They holler jobs, jobs, jobs. That's the biggest crock creating jobs. That's still making jobs. The key to the daggone job situation is put so much high tariffs and taxes on these goods that's coming in. If we're even tooled to do those jobs anymore, is make them bring them back. That is, Bob, that's the simplest.
You do know we tried that, right, Ed?
No, I didn't.
It was called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, and we did that smack dab in the beginning of the Great Depression, and it crushed us.
Okay, well, I didn't know that. I know most acts like the Smith Act and all that, but I didn't realize that that had been tried, and so. Who crushed that? The politicians or the?
No, it started a worldwide trade war.
I don't give a dang. I don't give a dang on if it did. Does start any kind of war? I'd say
no. It meant that our goods couldn't sell. It, among other things, it crippled the credit markets again. When Wall Street and the banks were still reeling, we put tariffs on everything coming into the U.S. So everything that the U.S. was shipping out got tariffs hammered onto it, and they wouldn't sell.
Well, at least we're playing on even ground.
Not really, Ed, because it's not even ground, because we start out with a tariff, and the other side, and some other country puts a tariff on our goods that's higher than our tariff on theirs. So we raise ours, so somebody else raises theirs. And the next thing you know, it's just a tariff war.
Do you mean to tell me, though, that we do not have the intelligence and the industry qualifications and the people qualifications to run this country internally almost efficiently without outside input?
Well, it's a more complex question than what you're asking. The first answer is no, we don't have that anymore. You know,
if it was done.
Yeah, but look, Ed, consider the Great Depression and the onset of World War II. We had factories that could make stuff, but they were idled for financial reasons. When it was time to crank it up to fight the Second World War, we had a workforce and we had an industrial manufacturing base. And so we could make what we needed during the Second World War. Interestingly enough, financed by the United States government. You know, the private sector didn't fight the Second World War, but that's a separate topic.
Yeah.
But we'll have that now. And the time that it would take to build that back up is time that we don't have. We would just continue to get worse. Now, the second part of your question, or my second answer to your question, lies in the fact that it may be us doing stuff, making stuff and so forth. But Ed, the money, for as rich as this country has been, a great deal of the finance has always been outside of this country, whether it was the English or the Dutch or the Japanese, and now it's the Chinese. You know, this is all rather complicated. If we crush, for instance, the Chinese economy, they hold our debt and they call our note, and that crushes us because George Bush spent 8 years when it wasn't necessary, hanging bad paper all over the Asian mainland, in order to finance, you know, not a rebuilding program for American economies, not shoring up the middle class. George Bush hung bad paper all over Asia in order to finance a war that we didn't, two wars that we didn't need to be in, and to prop up tax cuts for his pals. We had 8 years writing hot checks.
Yeah, but that still don't, that still isn't necessarily what's killed our economy. It's funny that all the other nations has fallen with us. If we fail, everybody fails. Well, it's beyond my understanding how that this can go on. Looks like our progress or our success would depend on what we do and not on what China, and I know what you're saying about them holding the notes and they got a hammer over their head. I would be the first to agree with that. But as long as people still undermine, and I've talked to people when they mention Walmart, I tell them, well, you're another one of them that undermines this country. And until we get some of those jobs back over here, probably jobs that they've exported in the last 2 years would put the people back to work. Good paying jobs. But they're in India or wherever.
Whether they're good paying is open to discussion. I mean, the reason, for instance, that telemarketing jobs went to South Asia and Southeast Asia and points elsewhere, the reason those jobs went there is because there was a virtual slave labor workforce that would work for pennies on the dollar. Consider that someone doing technical support in a U.S. call center, okay, for some computer or some such. You know, in other words, you know, it's inbound telephone work. That person might have been making it $12 an hour. Now, under no set of circumstances is that a living wage in the United States. So
well,
those people,
that's $27,000 a year, and it beats what they're making now.
And from a labor standpoint, that's exact, you know, and let things continue, and that's the, and that's how corporate America will think, because that's the point. You take the American jobs away to somewhere else, and you pay, you know, if they were making $12 an hour in the United States, somebody working this in India is maybe making $3. Okay? So that's $9 net profit to the corporate bosses. But what happens is when all the jobs are gone from America, American wages stagnate and start to deflate and go down. And once American workers are desperate enough, we bring them back and we tell them, well, here's a job for $9 an hour. You ought to be happy to have it. You know, we've got a governor in this state.
Where they're heading, you know, China's not going to come up with their wages or these other countries. They expect us to go back to meet them.
Right, and that's what...
I don't know what the picture is, but it's still... you know what? It seems like you've got the counter answers to my questions or my statements, but I certainly don't agree with all this stimulus stuff at all. Now, I do agree that helping the people with direct checks will give them some relief for a while, and the tax break that they're giving the middle class, it will help them. But it's nothing, and the answer is, give me a job.
And you know
give
what?
Me something we can depend on.
We can do that. I just spent a week listening to the reality of that. The fact of the matter is, there is one way. To bring good-paying jobs to the United States of America that aren't somewhere else. And that is in what is called the greening of the economy, Ed. That's wind and solar and geothermal.
I'm 110% on top of that.
Well, just think about it for a minute. What happens when GM shuts down a production plant? Say, you know, somewhere making Hummers, and they shut down Hummer. What happens to those workers? They're just out on the street, right?
They're out on the street or have to hunt some scabby job that is just barely keeping body and soul together.
And General Motors isn't standing there saying, "Well, we want to help you transition to a new way of earning a living."
Well, I guess the only answer I've got to that
is
I've got a little bit of land out here. I'll let them park their excess automobiles out here.
Well, just wait a minute. What happens, and you know, you and me, we live in a neck of the woods where you don't have to drive very far to see this. What happens when the coal plays out in a mine? What happens to that coal company town?
It's a ghost town.
Yeah, when the coal company packs up and leaves and takes the money it's made and goes away, the people don't matter. It's a ghost town.
That's right.
Now, in both of the examples that I've cited to you, Ed, there's only one answer, and that is to prepare people for a sustainable economy. Because for the foreseeable next couple of billion years, the sun is still going to be in the sky. And as long as the sun's in the sky and the earth is turning on its axis, there are going to be winds. And it is still mighty hot as you go down into the bowels of the earth. And that's all part of a complex relationship. And in the course of transitioning to an economy where our energy is based on wind and solar and geothermal, well, it's like the Coal River Wind Project, Ed. It'll take 14 or 15 years to take down Coal River Mountain. And after that, Massey will pack up bag and baggage, they'll take down all their facilities, and they'll go and destroy something else, if there's anything else left to destroy.
Oh, I know what the filthy bastards are.
The community dies, the community's poisoned, and Massey's not standing there saying, "Well, you know, we'll find another way for you to make a living." They say, "So long, suckers."
Yep.
Okay? Now, on the other hand, the Coal River Wind Project that would put windmills on top of those mountains, industrial wind, well, it's going to take 200 to 400 men and women working to build those things, and that's a two to four year job. After that, it's going to take a workforce of in excess of 50 people, permanent jobs, union jobs, with good wages and benefits and a pension and health care. It's going to take in excess of 50 people to maintain that wind farm. Now, those 50 people are going to go shopping, and those 50 people are going to need work clothes, and those 50 people are going to need work boots, and those 50 people are going to buy cars, and those 50 people are going to stop at little mom-and-pop grocery stores and get their bologna sliced for their sandwiches. All right?
If there's any mom-and-pops left.
This is the only way that there are. On the one hand, you've got very short-term mountain removal coal extraction that has a finite, definable end. And on the other hand, you've got a green economy that has no end in sight, where there will always be jobs. Think about it, Ed. Think about people who want to do wind and solar at their homes and have solar panels and wind turbines of their own. Because, you know, we live in West Virginia. It's kind of windy around here.
Mm-hmm.
My wife says it's terrible windy right here where we live. I don't think she's talking about the weather. But anyway, somebody's got, you know, mom, the people who own those things are not necessarily going to know how to maintain them. So an entire industry has to rise up around that to teach people how to maintain solar systems that heat water for solar steam heat in the winter, that teach people how to maintain wind turbines so that they can keep the electricity going to people's homes. This is the future. And the plants that manufacture the solar panel and the incredibly amazing complex films that coat those things that grab the rays of the sun more efficiently and bring them in. And we've got to have plants that build the lithium-ion batteries. And we've got to have people who can and maintain tower structures for wind turbines. All of these, we got to have plants to build the wind turbines.
Well,
you know, the fact of the matter is, Ed, you could probably take 1/7 of, you could take 700 billion divided by, you could, for less than $1 billion, you could probably replace the income of every single person working on a mountain removal job, create 2 or 3 more in excess of that, train them all to work in a green economy, build some green energy factories in West Virginia, and have complete employment and no more boom and bust economy like coal has brought us for 125 years.
Well, now I understand all that perfectly well, and I'm in.
And it would be money well spent, wouldn't it?
Yes, but the thing of it is, you're never going to sell these West Virginians on that, because right now coal is their payday, and these people, most of them, are so self-centered that they will not sacrifice even 2 weeks' work to get a better system established. And that's where you're going.
But nobody's that's what I'm proposing. Nobody's asking them to sacrifice a dime. I said income replacement, salary, penny for penny wage replacement for everybody working on mountain removal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a darn good idea if it can transpire, and if the people that's working on that can push it through. And you know where I stand on it. I don't like coal anyway. It's killed too many of my people. That's how I feel about it, with black lung, and not only that, with broke limbs and backs that's ruined from crawling around in low. I understand coal, and I despise it, and I despise anybody that's like Massey or Steve O'Brien or these like that support it. I understand it, but I don't understand production without a sale. That's what happened, and I said before, I told you this, that my mother told me that in the last Depression that you could buy a roll of bologna for a nickel, a roll, but nobody had a nickel. Now, that's what we're looking at if we're not careful. Right now, they still, the bottom of the barrel, I don't think, is here yet. But I don't think it's far off either. But I absolutely don't think that bailing out insurance companies and they keep coming back for more until if China would go ahead and recall their debt, where are we going to be?
Up a creek.
That's right. I ain't got too many paddles left. But
no
anyway,
kidding. No kidding. But you know the problem is you talk about bailing out insurance companies. See, that's a function of right wing deregulation. When you let Repiglicans have their way, Ed, they take banks, and next thing you know, the bank's selling you your cable service, or you go to buy your car insurance, and they want to sell you an investment, an investment product, or be your bank. Or the next thing you know, the insurance company's out there loaning businesses money. That's what happens. You know, would you, honest to God, would you buy insurance? No, never mind, because all insurance is a fraud. Would you buy a hammer from a company known for making foam rubber? Of course not.
Valid.
Of course not.
Yeah.
You know, would you buy nails from a toothpick manufacturer? Of course not.
I'd have to know their history.
Of course you wouldn't. Because they're toothpick makers. They're not nail. It's not a nailery. And yet, under Repiglican economic theory, so-called, everybody could diversify. You know, I had a conversation while I was in D.C., Ed, with an economist. you know, because you know how I am. I'll talk to a signpost as long as the signpost will stand still and listen. And I got talking to this one fellow, and I won't name names or anything, but he was explaining to me, and it was too much for my tiny mind, but I tried to wrap it around it. He was explaining to me that in world finance, the profit motive or the profit margin is on the sixth decimal place. You know, 1.000000. The profit is on the sixth decimal place. He said under Alan Greenspan and the right wingers, the profit motive got pushed out to the 16th decimal place. Can you fathom that?
Yep.
Does that make you as crazy? It made me want to scream when I heard that.
It tells you that the reason these merchants and all the rest can reduce their merchandise, the amount they do and still make a profit, that what I've asked myself many times, wonder how much they was really making before. If they can sell us stuff now at the price they're selling it and still not go out of business.
And that's the thing. They didn't go out of business because they were fudging all these numbers that far out on the decimal in decimal places. They were doing this all on debt. And it was all based on the concept that there would be more money to borrow.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's doing cash basis business. It's all of it. Every last bit of it's a scam. And, you know, you talk about, for instance, Ed, America doing for itself. We don't even, and this is scary. I mean, this is nightmare, you know, biblical famine stuff scary. We don't raise the majority of the food we eat in this country anymore.
Yeah.
Think about that. You and me, we love nothing better than a fresh tomato in the summertime. And I think if we had, between you and me, if we had the energy, we'd farm 40 acres and not, you know, 40 feet.
Yeah, well, I'm going bigger this year.
Me too. But the fact of the matter is, American farming has been corporatized to the point that a great deal, for instance, of our farmland is taken up in raising number two field grade corn that nobody can eat, but you can turn it into high fructose corn syrup and burn up people's pancreases with it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We've taken some of the richest farmland in America and built shabby ass McMansions on them that people would buy for a second home.
Yeah.
Or for a first home, you know, and live behind gates. Can you imagine living on? Have you seen some of these developments, Ed? Houses on yards the size of a postage stamp.
Yep.
Yeah, my mom and dad used to look at those things years ago, and they'd say, you know, I don't want to live in a place like this. I mean, I can throw a rock, and it wouldn't even throw a rock. I can
like
touch
to use a bathroom without the neighbor hearing me.
Amen. You know, if you can stick a broom handle out your window and touch your neighbor's house, that's too close.
Yeah. Well, it used to be out here, for to show you how far out I was. There wasn't nothing out here when I moved. And then when I got into it over this land project that was going to take place out here, I was told if you don't like it, move. And hell, I've been here for since 71, and they tell me to move if I don't like it. And I'm not against having neighbors, but not on my fence line and not where their dogs can use my yard.
Yeah, sure.
So,
but, you know, by golly, if the economy hadn't gone in the toilet, they'd be building those houses on top of you while we speak, Ed.
Oh, yeah. If they could find a way to get a septic tank, but they was going to force us to go on a city-type
sewer system? City sewer?
Yeah. They was going to come up with something like that out here. And, of course, we were opposed for a fight, but it probably wouldn't have done no good. But this still isn't completely dead. Yeah, the only thing that's is stopping them is, like you said, we're in a financial crunch right now. But I don't want somebody coming in living on, you know, building right on top of me. And my land connects right on to all these hundreds of thousands of acres out here. And, you know, I've tried to buy them, but they won't even sell me. They won't even sell me an acre behind me now. You know, I wanted to get another acre.
Right.
It just ain't for sale. You know, they'd rather sell an acre of it for $30,000 to $40,000, which they have done that, but they can't build on it because where they build is so, or where they sold is so rocky that they, and so deep in rock that they can't put septic and drainage in. So right now that's one of their hangups. Plus, like you said, I figure the economy is combined in with those same factors. But listen, I know you got other callers, and I would like to talk to you sometime further on, maybe go out and have breakfast or something.
That'd be nice. That'd be nice.
And talk a little further, because my concept is, at one time, we were almost self-sustaining, except for rubber. And now, we can make our own rubber. And I don't understand why we can't slowly take steps to, I'm not talking about crushing other people's economy just overnight. I'm talking just slowly taking back what was once ours. And until we get jobs to support our communities and our people and our nation, that seems like the simplest form of an answer to me. And probably it would take some more explaining. But
well,
I appreciate your time.
Well, it's I'm no economist, and economics are maddeningly frustrating, Ed, because they treat it like a science, but it isn't one. It is.
It seems rather simple to me.
It is on the one hand, it is, and on the other hand, it's maddeningly complex.
Well, it's complex because the interwoven situation these other countries. But that don't mean that we can't break contact slowly or a little bit at a time from them and let them come up to our standards. If we're going to lose these jobs, make them get rid of these 12-year-old kids that's working in China 12 hours a day for $3 a week.
Hillary Clinton went to China a week or so ago. And she told the leader of China that nothing could get in the way of business.
You know, we don't have a political system anymore that's run by the people. Business does run. It's like Carnegie said, we'll give them a dollar on the hour, but we'll never let them have Washington. And that's just about the way it is. We will never, you know, I don't see us ever gaining control of our own destiny again because of how much out of hand. And the thing of it is, it doubled with George Bush. The rotten, there isn't enough words to describe what a scum sucker he is. And they try to backtrack his stuff all the way to Carter, and I agree that they could have done some things that would have made it better that they missed. But George Bush, he opened the doors to all the boardrooms against the working people.
Amen, amen. And that's the, you know, those are the problems we have to solve. Ed, good talking to you, brother.
Same here. Appreciate your time.
You want to listen in for a little while longer?
I sure do.
All right. Well, stand by. I'll put you back on hold.
All right. Thank you.
Uh-huh. That's our buddy Ed calling from here in Fayette County. More common sense in his little finger than a lot of folks have in their entire extended families. Well, we're going to take a little break. It's about 7 minutes past the hour of 8 o'clock here in the Eastern time zone. And come back and talk about some other stuff. I told you earlier how impressed I am with Jason Isbell in the 400 unit. I do this solely as a, you know, there's certainly no money changing hands here or anything. I love this album, and I just want to share another track or two with you. I think you'll find all of this more than compelling stuff. So we'll take a little break and come back. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Locally, or on your nickel, 304-658-3333. And you are more than welcome to chime in if the mood so strikes you. Email rolls into Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Showed you the stone. sleep while the soldiers get sunstroke. Make little fools of ourselves. Oh, we make little fools of ourselves.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
All righty, about 14 minutes past the hour, about 40 minutes or so. Great conversation potential left in the program for this evening. And let's start that off by going straight to the phone. Our buddy Alan joins us from somewhere down the road. Let me make sure I've got the right button here. Is that you, Alan?
Bob.
No, that's Ed. Okay, stand by, Ed.
Yep.
There's Alan. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. You hear me?
I got you.
Oh, okay, good. I'm down in Waco, Texas now. I seem to wind up here a lot.
Yeah, they got you on the Texas track these days, don't they?
Yeah, I just came from San Angelo, Texas, and that seems like a nice place. They have a real nice museum there, Museum of Art.
Oh, yeah? What kind of museum?
It's a Museum of Art, just regular art, visual art, and the art museum itself is shaped like a big, I guess the roof line, if they makes you think of a big, old tiny wagon or something, like you see in the Western movie.
No, like a Conestoga wagon? Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the canvas nice top and it flopping along going down the trail. Yeah.
Yeah, It's a real nice structure, so maybe your listeners might want to go to the internet and look it up. And I was just listening to you and I think it was Ed before me.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about trade tariffs. And I was just, how in the world did we get such a disparity between trade tariffs, between what we have to pay sending out and what we charge others coming in, if it's true or not?
Well, the fact of the matter is, for instance, Japan was very, very protective of its markets in years past. And it was nigh unto impossible to get an American car into the Japanese market I'm willing to be corrected, but that was my understanding. Of course, there was some stupidity involved on Detroit's part, too. But that's part of it. You know, we had the potential at one point in time, Alan, to absolutely drown the world in our products, and nations the world over put up trade barriers to us. Meanwhile, however, because at one point in time we consumed more than we could make, well, we didn't have those same trade barriers, and we were happy to have other people's trade goods. So that's how that imbalance starts. And then, you know, when you factor in things like the price of oil, our trade deficit skyrockets because of what we don't produce. You know, that's another thing that points toward the absolute necessity of the green economy. It's the only, you know, these idiots in the right wing
want to babble on about, only we drill in the, we can drill wells with wolf teeth in the Arctic National Water. It's not gonna dramatically change the balance of trade issues that stem from our reliance on overseas oil, foreign oil, whether that oil is coming from Saudi Arabia or coming from Canada or Mexico. It just won't.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, however, if we start using the sun and the wind to generate the vast majority of our needed electricity, and figure out ways to use that generated electricity in turn to power our vehicles, whether they be mass transit trains or whether they be personal automobiles, then suddenly that trade deficit diminishes dramatically because of what we are not importing from outside oil sources.
Yes, I read the other day that the second largest holder in News Corp, the company that has Fox News, is a Saudi Arabia.
Wouldn't surprise me a dime's worth.
Yeah, I looked it up on Google Finance. It's a Prince Alawid is the name.
Wouldn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me. And, of course, they in turn, nobody knows better than the Saudis what happens to them if the world begins to get off oil. They sink back into the sands and become as irrelevant as they were before oil was found there. For heaven's sakes, when the Arabian Peninsula was a part of the Ottoman Empire, most people on Earth couldn't have found it on a map because it was utterly inconsequential, and so was Qatar, and so was the islands, Dubai and so forth, utterly inconsequential. For the most part, so was Persia. So was Mesopotamia. It was all inconsequential until it turned out that our oil was under their dirty sand. And then suddenly they found themselves invested with the power to shake the world from their vantage point as the tail of the dog. And frankly, if for no other reason, it would be nice to rebuild the green economy so we can tell the Saudis, who have manipulated the oil market so mercilessly, to go and, pardon me, piss up a rope. You know what I mean?
Yeah, same with all the people like the Bushes who deal with them. They've gotten rich off dealing with them, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and Cossack in the chat room even points out that when the Ottoman Turks ran that corner of the world, getting posted to Saudi Arabia was a sure sign that you were not in the Sultan's favor. It was Saudi Arabia was in the Ottoman Empire the equivalent of being posted to Siberia.
Yeah. I read that there's a lot of diamonds. They're finding a lot of diamonds there now. I'm not sure if that's true or not.
Oh dear. Well, they're probably looking for them because, like I said, no one understands better than the Saudis how irrelevant the Saudis will become if we get free of our addiction to their dirty oil.
Yeah. I think that alternative energy won't be a panacea. We have to go to cutting back on our wastefulness also.
Absolutely. You know, we can't. Friday night, I heard Van Jones speak. And he made a very strong point. He said, yeah, we can't build this green economy and keep on thinking the way we think. He said, or else we'll be blowing up Appalachian mountains and pushing stuff over into the valleys with solar powered bulldozers and fighting wars for lithium for batteries instead of for oil. And he's right.
Uh-huh.
There is within the green movement is an absolute prerequisite, Alan, that we think in terms of how the world goes forward and exists in some to, in some degree of peace and harmony. You know, the Air Force was a big proponent of liquid coal fuel for its jets. Can you imagine that? Poisoning people in coal country, stealing their water, polluting their streams, filling up their valleys to put fuel in a jet to go drop bombs on brown people? Yeah, that's just bass-ackwards crazy. And just the little bit of time that I got to spend talking with the folks from Black Mesa in Arizona just broke my heart. My heavenly days. There are people living. Yep, there are people living on that reservation who do not have drinking water. They do not have running water in their homes. They poop in a hole in the ground. Meanwhile, Peabody Energy is drilling the water out of their reservation to mix with coal to put it in a pipeline to send it to a coal-fired power plant. Yeah, how in the name of heaven, Alan, is that not a crime against humanity?
Yeah, I agree with you.
And there's John McCain and John Kyle, those two good-for-nothing, dead-from-the-neck-up senators from Arizona and Arizona state government. And even the tribal government on the reservation, all of them in bed with Peabody Energy.
Oh, man.
And I will eventually have the woman that I spoke to on the program, I'll have her on the show to talk about her life and what's going on the reservation there.
I thought there was uranium mining was a problem there.
That too. You know, at the demonstration on Monday, there was even an Aboriginal woman from Australia who came to Washington, D.C. to speak to what's going on. And she talked about the coal that is being dragged out of the earth in Australia. And she talked about it passionately. And then she added in the equation of uranium. She said, my people can no longer have babies because of the uranium that is mined in Australia and sent abroad for use in reactors all over the world. You know, that's the thing, Alan. I'm not yelling at you. You know that. We're buddies.
Yeah.
That's the thing, though.
Just laying it out.
You know, that capital coal-fired plant. You know, that thing was not sitting up in a nice neighborhood of D.C. I mean, I'm not saying that the neighborhood it's in isn't nice, but they put it where working people are. They didn't put it where senators have their apartments or congressmen have their little townhouses. Oh, heck no. They put it where little babies breathe that garbage. 'Cause they can. You know, here's a news flash. My senator, Jay Rockefeller, has a very nice home over in Pocahontas County, West Virginia. Guess what? They're not blowing up mountains near Jay Rockefeller. They're blowing up mountains near me and Judy Bonds and Lorella Scarborough and Vernon Haltom and Bo Webb. Because we don't have Rockefeller money. You know, John McCain during the campaign season, if you recall, Alan, they talked about how he invited the press to come out and visit with him at his cabin. Well, it turned out his cabin was a daggum mansion. Guess what? They're not drilling the water and blasting the coal near John McCain's cabin. They're doing it to people who have lived on that land for 20,000 freaking years.
Yeah.
God, it gets under my skin.
Yeah.
And you know that plant in D.C., Alan. You know that. You know what that thing's for? They burn the coal there to generate steam and cool water for air conditioning for the Capitol building. Uh-huh. And the last time they tried to shut it down, Mitch McConnell and Robert Byrd were the ones who made sure that they kept burning the coal for the babies who live a block away from it to breathe. As I was walking to the march, a guy came toward me from the other direction on the sidewalk and said, "Man, is that place burning coal?" I said, "Yeah, brother, you bet it is." He said,
"And then where the coal comes from?"
But wait, oh yeah, he said, "You mean we still burn coal for electricity in this country?"
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not gooning on the guy. Nobody thinks about this stuff. They think we live in the 21st century. And that in the 21st century, we ought to be able to figure out a way to not burn coal anymore. And he's right.
Uh-huh.
But we do burn it, not because we don't know any other method, not because we don't have any better alternatives, but because there are hide-bound, old, right-wing, coal-bought-off extremists in our government who insist that my children get poisoned. Sorry, old SOBs, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I've been getting some emails from Sierra Club about the mountaintop removal, which I'm glad that they're into it now. And a woman named Ashley Judd, the musician.
Yep.
Did you see her up there?
No, I did not. I don't think she was in D.C., but I know about her stance. Daryl Hannah was there. And one of my favorite character actors, James Cromwell, was there. You know, the guy who played the farmer in Babe? You know, "That'll do, pig." That guy? He was there. A number of other people were as well, but, you know, me, I somehow never managed to get close to the fabulous people.
So did you say that you were an actor?
Oh, once upon a time, yeah, I tried my hand at it.
Because when I went to Helen, I saw they had some stands and it looked like the place where it had
they do the miracle worker at Ivy Green every summer, and I've done it.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's great. I bet that was fun.
Oh, it was. It was a wonderful experience. And we got to run around on the grounds of Ivy Green and climb the tree that Helen got stuck in, and it's just cool.
I think it's amazing that they still have the original water pump there too.
Yeah, we kind of skirted the rules when Ferg was younger. I guess it would be about 3 years ago this time, and it was cold outside. But I got one of the folks, the ladies who works there, I said, "Listen, my son is up in West Virginia with us, but I grew up around here, and he's been reading about Helen Keller, and he's just amazed by her, and she's a heroine of his. Could he go inside the rail and just touch the pump?" And she said, "Well, sir, we don't let people do that." I said, "No, you don't. I grew up here. I've never touched the pump." And she goes, "Oh, okay, you understand." And she opened the gate and let Ferg go in and just, you know, touch it and feel it. And wow. And he was blown. He's still blown away by it. And one of the things we didn't get to do in Washington, D.C., yet, it's on Ferg's list. He wants to go to the National Cathedral where Helen Keller is interred and pay her his respects. And you know what? That's one of those things that really inspires me about my son. Things like that matter to him.
I got some good photos of the pump, if you'd like for me to send you one.
Oh, yeah, please.
Okay.
And I'll show it to Ferg, and he'll be tickled to see it.
Yeah. And you were talking about the auto manufacturers in Alabama recently. And when I used to drive a truck, you know, a big truck, I know I went to a place down in South Alabama. I think it's called Bryan, Alabama. I'm not sure. And I picked up a load of automobile parts, and I took it to Chrysler in Kokomo, Michigan. So there's automobile parts in Alabama that depend on Chrysler and Ford, I guess, too.
Right. And the thing is, if Detroit goes down, it's like watching dominoes fall. It really is.
Yeah, and also when you buy a foreign car, even though if it's made here, a majority of your profits are going to go overseas. So that's nothing to brag about just because it's made here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, be safe as you travel about Texas. When do you get to home, head back for Bama?
I don't know. I'm not really ready. I'm just going to stay out here and make some more money, hopefully, and see the sights.
Well, here for making more money. Everybody, I know exactly, yeah. And so
hey,
just...
I got something to tell you. When some mentioned socialism,
mm-hmm.
ask them how many toll roads have they driven on today.
Ooh, that's a good one, and that's something that somebody who drives for a living would notice.
Yeah, there's only one toll road around your place, but there's hardly any. You know, you drive to the supermarket and stuff like that in a day, and you don't think about it, but all those roads are socialism.
Sure, they are.
So if
and look, you know, think back to World War II. What I mentioned talking to Ed. The government was buying all those airplanes and tanks that put those factories back in action. I guess we socialized. I guess that was a socialized war machine we were running there too, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But it didn't seem to bother Ford and GM and IBM and the rest of them when their prices were stock prices were going up, did it?
No. Oh. They like to make that money.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing. We socialize the risk and privatize the profits. I mean, it's so very true. They love government activity as long as they're getting the tasty part of that activity. That's what makes them hypocrites, Alan. Plain and simple.
Yeah. Hey, there's one saying that I heard the other day on Democracy Now. They're talking about mountaintop removal. They have some guests on there about your meeting up in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, that was Judy Bonds was one of those.
Yeah, that was a pretty good episode. And I think it's her who mentioned the term clean coal is a dirty lie.
Exactly. And it was, about a week ago that our buddy John Woffen, whom I finally got to meet briefly, by the way, that he was on to announce the launch of thedirtylie.com. And so that website's out there, and it is really something. And I think they're gonna make a lot of hay with that. And did you see the ad that went around, Alan, of the clean coal spray?
No.
Oh, it's hilarious. It was directed by the Coen brothers. You know, the same people who did Oh Brother Where Art Thou and Raising Arizona and all of that. And,
I heard about it though. Yeah.
Well, and it ran on several cable channels. CNN said they weren't going to run it.
And then they changed their mind.
And then they changed their mind. They changed their mind because they got a whole bunch of email.
Right.
So the next step is to get them to stop taking coal money at all.
Uh-huh. That would be good.
Exactly.
Get them to start taking money from advertisement for something like that from the solar and wind.
There you go. There you go. Well, stay safe, Alan. Good talking to you, brother.
Hey, what was that website again?
TheDirtyLie.com.
Okay, I'll look it up.
All right, we'll talk to you soon, Alan.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Alan on the road in the wilds of Texas. Email rolling in from William. He says, I understand all the arguments and both sides of the issue on the subject of the auto industry. However, just to add my 2 cents I found in the couch cushion, what strikes me most is the way the big three have run their business, and in a way, it reminds me a lot of the HMO swills that determine and allow desk chair ass-shaped fools who know nothing other than numbers to sit at the helm and make decisions, when in fact the people who do know what works well should be doing this work, which would be the long-term production worker or the doctor in the case of the abominable HMO. Another bug I have is to say we do green, what's to say these products will be made in America since capitalism demands cheap labor? Oh, we could install the products and maintain the grids, but who has all the money on earth to take control of this new green energy? The oil companies. Sort of pushes out the independent. Now, I understand every bit of that, William. And that's what makes the kind of stuff that that Van Jones is talking about so very important. If you want to go to greenforall.org, and there is a reference there. Let me double check here just to make sure that I'm not just talking through my nostrils. There we go. I tell you, it's so nice to be back behind the microphone here. You know, everything works and, yeah. Yeah, greenforall.org. And Van Jones has a book that is really a kind of a must-read that talks about all this. How to make a green economy that has that kind of social justice element to it. That's why he said it, you know, if we don't change the way we think, we'll be running solar-powered bulldozers on mountaintop removal jobs and fighting wars for lithium for the batteries. It's not just an economic move. The green economy idea is an amazing synergy between economics and social justice and environmental justice that pulls together the whole picture. And it's possible to have these jobs be American jobs if we demand that they are American jobs. You see, when companies, for instance, build wind turbines in Germany, they have to pay the German workers building the wind turbines a fair and decent living wage. Because German law says so. The same thing happens in Spain. Because the people of those countries have demanded it and insisted that it be enacted. That can happen here. As Albert has pointed out a number of times, Detroit is more than capable of turning out light rail for the whole country and having higher employment than what they have now and still building cars. It can happen. We can build wind turbines and solar panels in Appalachia, and we can put to work the people who were blowing up mountains before. It can happen. But here is the really tough little nut of the problem. It has to be made to happen. It has to be compelled. This is not the final act of Peter Pan, and no matter how much you sit there and clap for Tinkerbell to live, damn it, live! It ain't gonna happen. We gotta get up off our butts. We gotta talk about it everywhere we go. See, I really do. I try to live some of this stuff. Agnes and I were in the grocery store earlier today. You know, the ubiquitous, you know, we were doing something else, and, you know, honey, we got to get a gallon of milk. So we go in the Kroger. And we're standing there checking out, talking to this, talking to the guy who's checking us out. And we've talked to him on a number of occasions, you know, because Agnes and I, we're funny that way. We like to talk to other people. We like to hear their ideas, hear what, you know, human conversation. Here in the hills, we call it neighborliness. And Agnes, remembering a previous conversation, told him that we don't buy a lot of the prepackaged, vacuum sealed, frozen fish that's purveyed anymore because of overfishing. And he remembered the conversation, and that in turn established a connection between us. And he said, yeah, I don't buy it either. But I don't even feel good about fishing it around here anymore, if what I read's true. And then out of the corner of my eye, I saw back behind Agnes a guy in a ball cap. And the reason it caught me was I saw out of the corner of my eye a navy blue ball cap with a little gold oval on it and some words Now, you know how it is out of your peripheral vision. You can't make it out, but you recognize. And I turned a little bit, and lo and behold, there he is unloading his groceries from his out of his cart and onto the checkout belt. And what's that cap say? Oh, if you've been listening to this program for any time at all, you know what that cap says. That cap said, "Friends of Coal." So standing there in that grocery line talking to our grocery clerk, good union man that he is, I said, "Yeah, I understand why you'd be nervous about eating fish out of any river or any stream around here." Kind of raised my voice up a little notch. I mean, I didn't, John Fox, I didn't take it up to 11 or anything. But I said, "Yeah, I'd be nervous about eating it. You got a right to be. You know, this isn't speculation. The mercury that comes from coal-fired power plants has made every fish on the eastern seaboard hazardous to human hazardous to our health and dangerous for human consumption." Only thing was, it was real cool because I didn't stutter like I just did. And I said, "Yeah, thanks to coal, we can't eat the fish, we can't breathe the air, we can't drink the water, and the ground's poisoned. And our houses shake from mountaintop removal." And by this time, the guy's standing there looking at me like if looks could kill, I'd have gone away in a basket. There wasn't anything he could do. Because I was standing there, and Agnes was standing there, and we'd already established a neighbor connection. And we were getting out facts, baby, facts. And all that Fokker could do was sit there and take it. And it was a lost cause. He'd been beat. Just like that dozen or so little Fokkers standing on the corner in Washington, D.C., hollering, "Coal keeps the lights out." Well, it doesn't at that plant. That plant ain't for nothing but steam. And, of course, there's good news in that because Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi already sent a letter saying, "We ain't going to burn no more coal there." That's all there is to it. It's all going to natural gas. Now, natural gas, another problem. But it's at least half as filthy as coal, and it's the beginning of a victory. Now, when that plant gets converted over to a solar wind geothermal plant, and this ain't rocket science, it's pre-existing technology. If you've ever listened to John Fox on All Foxed Up, you know about Spegs. Then we will know that we have won that fight. But those are the conversations we have to have. And it's so easy. Don't be afraid. All you got to do is look at that human being that you don't know and see a potential friend and a potential ally. And just dare to have a conversation. That's all there is to it. Easy, easy. 9 times out of 10, you come away with a new friend. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Kevin.
Hey, Kevin. What's up?
Yeah. First thing, I want to, like, educate you guys on one thing. I've heard a couple of conversations where they say the lights in New York skyscrapers are 24 hours and it's burning coal.
Yeah.
Okay, regretfully, yes, they do burn coal, but there's usually a night shift going on. It's a city that never sleeps.
Well, what John Woffen was talking about last week, unfortunately, were buildings he could see into, and there wasn't a soul in them.
Even so, it may be a skeleton crew, but very few buildings totally shut down. And they may be down in the basement, like in the IT department or something.
Right. But there's no reason they have to keep the lights burning in an empty room.
Yeah, you're right about that. And they could do a better job of turning off the lights and burning, you know.
And that's all we're doing, Kevin, is building some awareness. You know, when those lights get left on, we pay for it here. They pay the power bill, which is, if I was a building super or something, I wouldn't want the power bill for it.
Yeah. Well, nobody wants it.
But, so they pay the price on that end in terms of the power bill, but we pay the price here with our very lives. And I think it's okay to explain to people those kinds of things.
Oh, yeah. And you're absolutely right on that. You are. One thing, I think the problem with a lot of the global stuff with lithium and all that, until this country changes its very mental foundation, which is the acceptance of slavery, because America didn't,
there you go,
simply exported it to other countries.
Yeah.
Nothing is going to change.
Yeah, we want to pat ourselves on the back for 1865, or maybe for the Civil Rights Act, or the Voting Rights Act. See, we're fixing it here. We're fixing it. But you know what? No, we just exported it. You're absolutely right, Kevin.
And that is the problem, because the thing is, lithium, where does most of it come from? Bolivia. What kind of people live in Bolivia? Brown people.
Brown peasant people.
Yeah. Do we want to pay them a living wage? Absolutely not.
Right. And you and I are on the same page on that, Kevin, because what we've got to do is literally have a re-envisioning, a reimagining of what this world is versus what it can be.
Exactly.
I mean, can you imagine there is some right-wing politician out there urging, I think this happened today or in the last day or so, urging Obama to appoint Bill Frist as his special envoy to Darfur?
Why would he do that?
Oh, well, Bill Frist is a world-renowned heart surgeon. He's a compassionate doctor. Well, last I checked, you remember back when the tsunami hit the day after Christmas, or Christmas a couple of years ago?
Oh, yeah.
You remember when Bill Frist took a fact-finding tour there?
Oh, yeah.
And was caught telling the photographer, "Now, son, make sure you get a good photograph of me with lots of the devastation behind me, all right?"
Oh, yeah. Well, this is the same guy who owns basically the whole health industry in the South.
Yeah, Humana. Health South, or no, Humana.
Yeah. So, I don't expect.
No, yeah, I mean, I can see him in Darfur. Now, son, get a picture of me here with lots of the starving people behind me. I want to make sure the folks see me being compassionate.
Yeah, a lot of limbless people. Oh, God.
Yeah, see if you can get one of them. See if you can get one of them little starving stick people to hobble up here and stand next to me.
Yeah, exactly. And as long as and I'm sorry to say, because who's Rush Limbaugh's biggest segment audience? Not college educated people.
Oh no. It is angry, terrified, mostly older. White folks, white men. Even Limbaugh had to acknowledge on air that women hate his guts.
Yeah, well.
It's been pointed out that the Limbaugh's ratings, Kevin, his approval ratings nationally are lower than Reverend Jeremiah Wright's or William Ayers's.
Huh. Him and Hannity, their demographic. As long as you have angry, older, white men listening to this, it's going to be hard to change, because these guys, they have to die off, literally.
Yeah, and that's what makes something like Power Shift, where we were last week, so very important, because that's the next generation. For instance, Middlebury College and the University of Vermont together sent over 300 people. Now those 300 people are, if they've got any fire in their bellies at all, they're going to go back and talk to three people, and boom, you got 900. Yeah. And you know how the math works from there.
Yeah, the same reaction.
And I met people from Maine, I met some beautiful folks from Puerto Rico. You know, and there they are, and they're concerned, standing in the freezing cold.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about, you know, this matters, saying, you know, this matters in Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Well,
and it does.
It does. Well, it matters on every corner of the planet. Every corner of the planet, because, you know, the thing is, I've often said, if a commodity causes that much misery, maybe it shouldn't be sold. And that's the problem with carbon-based fuels. They cause way too much misery, whether in the process of getting it, in terms of oil and coal, where it just destroys the planet and people, and in the aftermath, because it goes into air and it still destroys the planet and the people.
Exactly. There's no that, and that's the point that all these folks are going to go home and drive home. You know, 12,000. There is no okay part of the coal cycle. It's dirty and filthy and toxic and fatal when it's taken out of the ground, all the way to the end process when you're dumping your fly ash upstream from somebody who has no idea that they're living in the with a bullseye on their backs.
Oh yeah, and it's sad because it's like, again, I often, what is the end game for conservatives? And I've come to the conclusion, remember that Will Smith movie, Wild West? Wild, Wild West?
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's not his best movie, but like I said to Mark.
Oh, wasn't Salma Hayek in that?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, that's why I remember the movie. No, it's not one of Will Smith's best. I remember Salma Hayek. Because
yeah,
I'm really shallow.
I can't believe that's not really shallow. That's just intelligent.
No, that's where you say, no, Bob, that's discriminatingly good taste.
Exactly. Well, usually good taste involves intelligence. I'll pretend Agnes is not listening.
Right. See, yeah, I'm safe right now. I can say these kinds of things.
Yeah. But that's their end game, to sell parts of this country off, privatize parts of this country, and make sure there's a little piece left for their wealthy elite. And their cronies.
Well, and that's exactly what they do, Kevin, because they make conscious decisions that, for instance, Native peoples on the reservation at Black Mesa just don't matter. And little hillbilly children in Appalachia just don't matter. Yeah. And I mean, there's nothing that makes me crazier. I think the guy's name's Hooten. I saw a letter to the editor in the Charleston paper from this guy. He's from Friends of the Potomac Highlands or some such, talking about, well, we can't have any windmills in West Virginia. Windmills will never work. Windmills just don't work. Well, all the science says windmills don't work and solar panels, the sun doesn't shine in West Virginia. We can't have any, because he's afraid somebody might put a windmill in the Potomac Highlands. He wants nuclear reactors in West Virginia as long as they're not in the Potomac Highlands. Okay? He's one of the, you know, the Fockers, the Friends of Coal, they're evil enough. But I swear, Kevin, the NIMBY people are even more evil. Because
not
they're
in
the
my backyard.
Yeah. Yeah, not in my backyard. Those are the people who say that it's okay for a woman not to have running water on an Indian reservation, but for the water underground from her to be stolen from her to that. Or that it's not okay, you know, now we can't have anything disturb our tranquil peace and our viewscapes in the scenic Potomac Highlands. But it's okay if you blow up the southern end of the state, because, you know, those people.
Oh, yeah.
And look right where you live. I have so much respect for Majora Carter and what she's done in the South Bronx there. You know, she's trying to create that paradigm shift, because once again, we're talking about a part of your city, where the powers that be determined that it was okay to just crap on people. And there's a movement there that says, no, it ain't. And I'm proud as punch of them. Look at anywhere they put one of these coal-fired power plants. They never put it next to the banker's house.
Oh, no. No. They'll never do that.
So, you know, so then, you know, your Wild Wild West analogy, because I did watch it all the way through, because you never knew when Salma Hayek was going to show up again.
Yeah.
Your analogy is valid. And it is. It's piecemeal, and it's the worst kind of, God, it's even beyond Machiavellian, the kind of, the hateful cost benefit analysis they go into. Kevin, I just looked down at the clock. Brother, we got to get out of here.
Okay, then.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Take care, and just tell the building super it's okay to turn out the lights in the empty rooms.
Well, I do it on my job, so. All righty.
All right, take care. Bye now.
Okay, bye.
Calling from New York City, our buddy Kevin. And that's it. Wow. I feel like I could do 3 more hours, but I'm not a gonna. I hope you enjoyed this evening as much as I did. Looks like there's plenty to talk about tomorrow. Hope you'll be there for that. Thanks for joining me this first night back and making it an extra special prayer meeting edition. Thanks to John Fox, our web designer, chief musician, chief engineer, host of All Foxed Up, returning as soon as he has completed his move. Thanks to Peter Godbold, our IT consultant, who makes all of these computers do his bidding at merely the threat of his name. Thanks to Ben Birch, the hardest working, most overworked man in liberal talk, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Everything you hear coming from the horn comes through the good offices of Ben Birch. Thanks to everybody associated with the horn. ELO, Lottie, News Ninja Susan, News Ninja Gene, Texas Betsy, Agnes. Thanks to